So we are in Genesis chapter 31. We're picking up at about verse 22. We have been covering the life and family of Jacob. This lists his sons. There's also a daughter who will come into play later named Dinah. She'll come up, in fact, probably in this class. But Jacob has two wives who are both sisters, just a recipe for success. There's nothing but envy and strife amongst the family. Jacob was a deceiver early on, so then he comes here to the land of Haran, and now he runs into, he meets his match, so to speak, in Laban, because Laban is also a deceiver, and so that's how he ends up marrying not just Rachel, but Leah, because he's tricked into marrying Leah first. And so his household has kind of been mired in lies and trickery and deception. And at this point, we read through it pretty quickly, but we want to keep in mind that it didn't happen quickly for him. He leaves the land of Canaan, because he's driven away because his brother Esau is going to kill him. And he leaves one kind of guy. But now he served 7 years for the first wife, and then another 7 years with Laban for the second wife. And then he served for an undisclosed amount of time to gain the wealth and wages that he currently has, of which Laban, it talks about, changed the terms of the agreement 10 times. So Laban's been pulling strings and trickery and deceit. So ultimately, you know, we have somewhere around 20 plus years, likely, of him being immersed in the fruits of deception. Let me put it that way. And what we're seeing is that, there's some truth, right? When God says a man will, whatever a man sows, so also he'll reap, right? There's some truth to that idea, isn't there? That he is a deceptive guy, and then he finds himself wrapped up in that sort of trickery and then dealing with the fruits of it. But then also, what we're going to see is that out of that, as he prepares to leave with his family, which in chapter 31 here, when we finished up last week, you can see down in verse 20, it says, Jacob deceived Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him that he was fleeing. So he fled with all that he had, and he arose and crossed the Euphrates River and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. So even in leaving, there's more deception, more trickery on his part, and he'll say openly, because Laban's going to confront him, he's going to tell Laban, the reason I did was I was afraid of what you would do if you knew. So it's not a healthy relationship by any means, shape, or form. But now, ultimately, with his family, he's leaving Haran, crosses over the Euphrates. So if you look here on the map, the Euphrates is that river right there. There we go. That's going to be better. There's that river. He crosses over there with the ultimate goal of coming all the way back down here. And so Laban, after 3 days, figures out that Jacob has left. And in verse 22, it says, when it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, then he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey. And he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. And God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream of the night and said to him, be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad. So here, God now speaks to Laban and says, don't speak to him either good or bad. Which tells you there's kind of an implication there of what Laban had in mind, right? Laban is not going there to be buddies. And so at least some of that fear that Jacob will point out of him being mistreated if he tries to leave, and that's why he left secretly, seems to be at least partially valid. So God tells Laban that. Laban, in verse 25, will catch up to Jacob. And down in verse 26, it says, Laban said to Jacob, what have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and did not tell me so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs and with timbrel and with lyre and did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Now you have done foolishly, it is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob. So he comes and tells Jacob essentially, hey, if you had been open about this, we would have, I could have sent you away with happiness and joy and everything. Does that actually mean that he would necessarily have done that? No, not necessarily at all. I mean, maybe. We don't know. But in the statement, when he says, it is in my power to do you harm, you can kind of see that back and forth between the relationship Jacob and Laban. It's not a healthy one, right? You don't typically go to your friends, to people you have a healthy relationship, and you go, just so you know, it's in my power to do you harm. But, you know, your God spoke to me, and so I'm not going to. And he refers to him, by the way, it's interesting as you look at Laban here, because there's several different things that come up in this particular chapter. One, when they left, Rachel took something. Anybody remember what Rachel took? Took the household idols. Yeah, she took Laban's household idols. And Laban here, when he talks about Jehovah, about God, he refers to him as the God of who? Yeah, the God of Jacob and the God of your father. In other words, somebody else's God, right? He doesn't say, it's my God. So Laban is not a God-fearing man necessarily himself, having all of those idols and then just in the way he refers to it. And so then you move on down to verse 31 and you see Jacob's, verse 30 says, now you have indeed gone away because you long greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my God? So he brings this charge to him that he has stolen his gods. Now Jacob knows nothing about this. Rachel has done it, but Jacob doesn't know anything. So verse 31, Jacob replied to Laban, because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. The one with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So Laban's going to make a search of things when he comes to Rachel's tent. She's going to say that she's menstruating and will be she's hiding the idols underneath her. And so she's going to get away with it. She's going to get away with stealing these idols. But then you go down in after that event, Jacob's going to have this, you know, kind of final conversation with Laban. And in verse 36, he'll tell him, it says, Jacob became angry and contended with Laban, and Jacob said to Laban, what is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn of beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was, by day the heat consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night. So, there are a couple of things that get out of this. One, can you see the problem between Jacob and Laban? I mean, this is not healthy, right? This is not a friendship or anything like that. For all accounts, Laban has been very deceptive. But the other piece of it that's very interesting to me is when you look at the way that Jacob describes serving for those 20 years, and the kind of man that he was during that time, does that match the kind of guy he was with his brother Esau? They're not the same, are they? The guy he was when he left, fled for his life, was a trickster and a huckster and a deceiver. Now, on the other hand, when he turns to Laban, he says, show me what of your stuff I've taken, and tell me how I've done wrong, because anytime something happened to the flock, I incurred the cost. I've been honest with you. I've been fair. And if that were not the case, what's the first thing Laban's going to say? I mean, if he says, I've never stolen anything from you, but he actually had, do you think Laban would call him out on it? He totally would, right? These aren't friends. And so what Jacob is saying is true, that he has dealt with integrity during this time period. So what we're seeing is a change in man. That's what I like about Jacob. So there's a lot of things to not like about Jacob, especially early on in his life, but as his life progresses, Jacob is a great example of somebody who can change. He changed from a deceiver into somebody that could show integrity. And so starting in verse 43, Laban and Jacob will make a covenant, essentially that the two of them will not fight with each other. They're going to accept things as they are, bury the hatchet, so to speak. And it says in verse 46, Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. So they took stones, made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. And now Laban called it Jagar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. And so those two, by the way, the first name and the second name, they actually mean the same thing. They mean a heap of witness. But one is in Aramaic and the other is in Hebrew. So when people talk about the languages that the Bible are written in, there's three languages it's written in. It's written in Hebrew and Greek, which is the vast majority. The New Testament is Greek, the Old Testament is Hebrew, but then there's a third language, Aramaic. This is a good example of it. So there's not much Aramaic in the Bible, but technically speaking, there is some. So they use the two languages, and it says, Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore, it was named Galeed and Mizpah, for he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from the other. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. And so they come to this agreement. They're going to part ways. And that ends the era of Jacob there in Haran with Laban. A couple of interesting things in this passage in particular are the way that God is spoken of. We already mentioned the one in verse 29 where he says, the God of your father spoke to me last night. Verse 42 names God again. He says, this is Isaac speaking this time, the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me. That's there where he says, if God had been for me, you know, Laban, you would have destroyed me. But that language of referring to him as the God of his father, which is Isaac, and the God of Abraham, which is his grandfather, and then calling God the fear of Isaac. Now, that's an interesting statement, too. When was the last time you thought of God in terms of his title being the one we fear? And yet, that's the language used, and it's proper to use that sort of language, right? Proverbs says that the fear of Jehovah is the beginning of wisdom. So, Jacob understood that idea, that his father had feared Jehovah. Laban will use the term in verse 53 as the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. Abraham and Nahor were brothers. Nahor was Lot's dad, I think that's right. One of Abraham's brothers, and then the God of their father as well. So, so you're looking at, the reason I point this out is, as you read this section, we're reading through this time period in history, the term God doesn't necessarily mean the one true God, does it? They're differentiating between there's the God of Abraham, and then there's all these other gods too, right? And so the world that they're in is steeped in idolatry. This idea that there is one true and living God is a different idea than what's seen everywhere else. And then from there, we move to chapter 32. Does anybody have any questions on chapter 31? Yeah. So probably while they were in Haran, they would have been speaking Aramaic. Yeah, so that would have been the language that would have been spoken in general. Well, the Hebrew language goes all the way back to Abraham. We're going to see if I can do this right. So Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees, and Haran, where Laban was, is a different area. There's about 1,100 miles or so between the two. When the time period in which Hebrew kind of became its own distinct language, that would go beyond my scope of knowledge off of the top of my head. But Aramaic was spoken up, not where Abraham was from. That's my point, is Abraham was not from the same area that Laban was living. Laban was living in the Aramean area. So, right. Yeah. Right. And my guess is it didn't start with Abraham. I think my guess would be that Abraham brought it with him from Ur, because that territory there where Ur of the Chaldees is one of the oldest known civilizations. When you start dating civilizations that we've actually dug up and researched, they don't get much older than that. So Hebrew, whenever it began, is pretty ancient language. And that would be, I've never actually looked at to the point of saying, where was the impetus of it? Where did Hebrew actually begin? Now I'm going to have to go home and dig a little bit out of curiosity. But Hebrew is going to be a very ancient language that they would have brought with them. Abraham didn't start it, so he would have had it already. And that kind of remained as part of the family language as they moved to Canaan and everything like that. Yeah. Yeah, I would think so, because that he would have brought it with him from the Ur of the Chaldees, that Chaldean territory. So yeah. So I don't think he was the first guy to speak it, but whenever you start to divide people up, right, like the Tower of Babel, I mean, that's kind of the perfect example of it, right? You divide people, the language is what divided the people. It also works the other way. When people divide, the languages separate, which is why you sound like an idiot to British, right? I mean, that's they hear us speak, and it's deplorable to them that we get to still say we speak English, because to them there's been such a difference and a divide. And it really is just, we came and lived over here, a bunch of British people moved to another territory, and the language got lazy. as Abraham and family left, I imagine that probably is part of what happened too, is just the separation from other peoples would have made it more distinct. And once again there, I'm just kind of talking about in terms of how languages work in general, but not a specific knowledge of timelines. So, does that appropriately not answer your question? Yeah, I wish I did. I'm gonna have to go look it up. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That is an unknown, isn't it? Right? Is what's the motivation behind her doing it? Is she taking them because they're special to her, or is she taking them because they're special to Laban and she's letting him have it? Because it's very obvious they're not happy with him. Because even when Jacob says it's time to leave and asks his wives how they feel about it, they say, he's not making good to us. I don't know. I don't know. What do you think? Well, and that's true. I mean, there certainly was, we see in Rachel and Leah a certain amount of faith in God, even in the way they name their children, right? Even though they're mad at each other, they keep talking about how God has blessed them. Yeah, I would say that they were certainly more God-fearing than they were before. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Does that kind of answer it? Yeah. Okay, so then chapter 32, we now have to move. We're kind of out of the frying pan into the fire a certain amount. He's left Haran territory where Laban was the problem, but now he's going back to Israel. And when he goes back to the land of Canaan, to what will eventually be called Israel, he's going to run into the same guy that he was running away from in the first place, right? He's going to run into Esau. And so chapter 32, we immediately begin to run into this issue of Jacob heading back, and he's going to run into Esau, and how are we going to deal with that? Now, in the midst of that whole process, we have a very strange event. And I'll just put it simply that way, that in chapter 32, it begins with them moving into the country of Edom, or moving towards it. So Edom's down here. They're going down there towards that area where Esau lives. Edom, by the way, is named after Esau. So that area south of what we know as Israel was where Esau's descendants were. But on the way, Esau's going to come, and he's going to plan on meeting Jacob along the way. And so Jacob begins to do a variety of things. Down in verse 9, it says, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I'm unworthy of all the loving kindness of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant, for with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. So here, he's coming back into the territory. He prays to God because he is afraid of Esau, and recognizes, when I left with nothing, but now I'm coming back with two companies. I've got a large family, lots of wealth, but my brother Esau is coming out, and he too is a very powerful man. In fact, we'll see that when he does in fact come out, he's going to come out with quite a few men with him. So Jacob is concerned about that. So he's going to send presents ahead. So what his plan is okay, I'm going to eventually catch up, but I'm going to send gifts to my brother ahead of time in hopes of appeasing him. And he'll tell the servants as they go ahead of time, down in verse 18, you shall say, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he also is behind us. So each troop that goes ahead will bring a gift. They'll tell him this is a present in hopes of appeasing him. And verse 19, he commanded also the second and the third, and all those who follow the drove, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him, and you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and then afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him while he himself spent that night in the camp. So he's going to stay behind, and while he stays behind with these presents going on ahead of time, a very unique event happens, of which I will tell you right up front, you will probably end up leaving with more questions than answers, because it's this event of Jacob wrestling with an angel. And so, verse 24, it says, then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Now, he's described as a man here, but it won't be long before we realize that he's not just a man, but he is an angel. And so, how this began. So, all we have is Jacob stayed behind, and then all of a sudden, the next thing we know, there's a man there, and they're wrestling. And so, if you ask me, well, how did that start? I don't know. I have no idea whatsoever. But as they wrestle, it says in verse 25, when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh, so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. And then he said, this is this angel, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So somehow Jacob seems to be aware of the fact that this is not just any old man. He's looking for a blessing. He won't let him go unless he gets that blessing. And he said, so he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. So here's the interesting thing. Jacob has these 12 sons who will eventually become the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel. And they get the name Israel from this event, when Jacob's name is changed to Israel. And it's a pivotal event, and it kind of is based off of the things that we just finished talking about and reading, is that he left a supplanter, right? The guy who takes stuff from other people, right? He took from Esau. He took the birthright. He tricked him. He tricked his dad to get the blessing there. But as he comes back after 20-some-odd years away, he comes back a different guy. He comes back a guy who has more integrity than he had before. And the one thing that he's shown himself to do is to be somebody who can persevere. Because, I mean, think about for a second, he served 7 years for Rachel, and then he finds out he doesn't get to marry Rachel, and he has to serve another 7 years. How many people would give up at that point? And then he serves another 6 years for his wages. So this guy has been through all these sorts of things. He left, as he said, when he crossed the Jordan to leave to go where Laban is, he left with only his staff. God had taken him to the bottom. And now he's coming back over, and he's persevered. And so the name he's given really matches what's happened with his life. He's moved from the deceiver to the perseverer, to the striver. Israel means one who strives with God. And he says, you've striven with God and with men and have prevailed. That is, you've fought on, and just like he wrestled that angel and wouldn't let go, the one thing that you can say about Jacob, there's so many bad things and mistakes that he made in his life, but the one thing you can say about him is the guy just doesn't give up, does he? He just has this perseverance about him of striving, and he just gets back up and he fights and struggles. And so he's given this name of one who strives with God and with men and has prevailed. So the name Israel matches that. So that is his blessing. And it's a blessing that will go on to be carried as the name of the nation. Now, when you think about the nation of Israel, is that going to match them a little bit too? Yeah. They're going to strive with God, not always in good ways though, right? But they're going to persevere. They're going to survive a great many things. And so down in verse 29, it says, Jacob asked him and said, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, which means the face of God. For he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore to this day the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of the hip. And so Jacob now crosses over back in the land of Canaan, bearing the name that all of us are much more familiar with, that Israel will be known as. And so we don't think of them as being Jacobites, right? We think of them as being Israelites. Anybody have any comments or questions on that section? Okay, well, from there, he will meet up in chapter 33 with his brother Esau. And as he goes before Esau, you see once again that kind of favoritism that continues to play out, because it says in verse 1, Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming. So this is the next morning, and 400 men with him. Well, if you're Jacob and you see Esau coming with 400 men, that would probably scare you a bit, I would think. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids, and he put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. Does that tell you anything? That favoritism's still there, right? But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. And then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children, and he said, "Who are these with you?" And he said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." And then the maids came near with their children, and they bowed down. And Leah likewise came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. And he said, "What do you mean by all this company which I have met?" Referring to all of those gifts. And he said, "To find favor in the sight of my Lord." But Esau said, "I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own." And Jacob said, "No, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." Thus he urged him, and he took it. The great thing about this story in chapter 33 here is there's a lesson there about reconciliation, isn't there? In the history of the world, I'm not sure that you could find two brothers who despised each other more. You might find some good competitors, but I'm not sure you would find anybody who had more problems with each other. But time and distance and maturity had done some pretty powerful things to both those brothers, so that now there is camaraderie and love and graciousness and forgiveness. And so there's a lesson there that, you know, you think about what people do to each other on this planet. I mean, let's just be honest about it for a second, that we can be pretty cruel to each other as human beings. And we can also sometimes be deeply offended faster than we ought to be, and quick to take offense. And yet, if we serve the Lord, as both of these men did, right? Because Esau talks about how God had been gracious to him, so Esau, though he's not the one that the lineage is going to come through, Esau himself serves God, right? And Jacob serves God. And they both started out as immature young men. But they've grown, they both serve God, they've matured, and what did that do to their relationship with each other? Reconciliation becomes possible when we put God first. See, this is the whole key to everything in life. We seek first God and His kingdom, and all these other things take care of themselves. If we put God first, then we become better people, more capable of forgiveness, more capable of mercy and love. And if every one of us as the Lord's people do that, there's not a single thing that we can't overcome, no matter how deep the pain. So they are now reconciled, and Esau says, verse 12, "Let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you." But he said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are frail, and that the flocks and herds which are nursing are care to me, and if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before a servant. I'll proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir." And Esau said, "Please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the place is named Succoth, which means booths. So they get to Succoth, which is here on this kind of the exploded out map, is right here. So they get to there, and Jacob says they make booths. Basically, they stop there for a while. They make semi-permanent places, and most likely the reason for that is he's just taken a massive journey, right, with all of his worldly possessions. And his worldly possessions aren't just things. like gold and silver and whatnot. They're animal, they're livestock, and having made that sort of journey at a fairly fast pace, probably for at least part of it because of trying to get away from Laban, he says, if I drive them hard even one day, what's going to happen? They'll die. So they go slowly with the thought that they'll run into Esau eventually. Any comments or questions there? Okay, so then in verse 18, Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram and camped before the city, and he bought the piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And then he erected there an altar and called it El Elohe Israel, or it also, that means God, the God of Israel. By the way, when you're seeing some of these names, whenever you see El, E-L, either at the front or the end, that means God. So Israel is one who strives with God. Beth-El is, oh no, I forgot what Beth means. Something God. Penuel is the face of God. And in this case, El Elohe Israel is God, the God of Israel. So whenever you see in those Hebrew names El, that E-L, that means God. Which is why a lot of the names of places have an L in it. So he buys this piece of land, and that's kind of a big deal. Why is that a big deal? Anybody know why this would be kind of a monumental moment in the history of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob? It's promised land, and he just bought a piece of it, right? First piece, that's it, the first cut, you know, the first claim. Abraham was told he didn't get to own any of it. But here now, he buys a piece of land, and now we're beginning to see them settle into this territory in a more permanent way than had been done before. Now, chapter 34, they've now bought this piece of land outside of the city of Shechem. So Shechem is, once again, we're right here on the map, outside of Shechem. And chapter 34 gives us this series of events that occurred while they were living in that territory, slowly but surely continuing their travels. Dinah, who is the daughter of Leah, so we've focused on the boys, but Dinah, Leah did have a daughter. She's going to be raped. I mean, there's just no nice way to put this. She's going to be raped by a man from Shechem. It says down in verse 2, when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. And he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this young girl for a wife. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob kept silent until they came in. And then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. Here's the thing that is very, very interesting. In such an absolutely horrible environment and event, right? It says such a thing ought not to be done in Israel, right? That's the boys, the brothers are grieved, they're upset because it was a disgraceful thing. They were very angry. It was a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. That is the reaction of the sons of Israel, is that we as a people think this is a horrible, degenerate thing. What was the reaction of Shechem and his father Hamor? I said, my son wants her as a wife. This idea that rape and taking a woman by force is a bad thing is a biblical idea. It is not something that you see across cultures as being something that's bad. It is something that the Bible teaches is bad, but many cultures and many other religions, including, by the way, the Quran, specifically say are not a problem. The Quran is very, now most Muslims in America don't read this and they don't talk about it, but the fact of the matter is the Quran is very clear on the fact that that a man can take a woman, or at least certain kinds of women, by force, and that it's perfectly fine. Muhammad said it was fine. And here, when they're outside the city of Shechem, the thought process here was, well, he loved her, he took her by force, and now he wants her to be his bride, so let's just make the arrangement, guys. But what's the attitude of those who had been taught even partially by God? They didn't have the total revelation of God that you and I have, but in Israel, that small nation of Israel that they were right then, what was already the view towards women? Completely wrong. Vile. Disgraceful. And so I say that, one, because that's kind of a thing in the culture that we're dealing with right now. This sort of stuff comes up. And then the other thing is, don't let anybody ever tell you that the Bible is not pro-women. It's always been pro-women. While everybody else was saying, well, it's no big deal. And after all, he's treating her tenderly. He loves her. He wants her to be his wife. Only in the land of Israel were they saying, no. No, this is a disgraceful and evil thing. So Hamor's going to speak. Ultimately, Jacob will say that the only way we'd even consider it would be if you were circumcised. Essentially, you have to become part of us. And so they make the decision at the city of Shechem to circumcise all the men so that they may, so that Shechem can marry her. And so verse 18, it says, now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. The young man did not delay to do the thing because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he's more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, these men are friendly with us, therefore let them live in the land and trade in it, for behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. So they go in, and all of the men of the city are circumcised. But then in verse 25, we find that it came about on the third day when all of the men were in pain. The two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male. And so Simeon and Levi choose to take it into their own hands to handle this by killing every male in the city of Shechem there. And Jacob will talk to them about how that has created some problems, as bad as what happened was, the answer is not to kill everybody in the city. But ultimately, that's how they handle it. And so Levi and Simeon will go through the city while all the men are recovering from their circumcision. And it says they each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male. And so down in verse 30, and this is where we'll finish up for tonight, he says, Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number. They will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household. But they said, should he treat our sister as a harlot? So there was obviously disagreement in the family of exactly how to handle it. But this particular event is recorded here in chapter 34 as being, you know, kind of a pretty big deal of things that happened. Does anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, then we'll stop there. We'll pick up in chapter 35 where Jacob will travel back to Bethel where he had originally had that vision of the angels ascending and descending from a ladder.